here we are. This is Sex, Love, Psychedelics, and I'm your host, Dr. Kat, bringing you psychosexual conversations that will leave you intellectually turned on and hungry for more.
Hey, lovers. I am so happy to be doing this episode. MDMA-assisted therapy is really beautiful, and it was actually a part of my own healing work in my early 20s, which I do share more about on the interview as it progresses. We are so lucky to have a voice like Jonathan Robinson here to pull back the curtains on this type of therapy and to show us what it's like to be on the inside of this treatment and what it's like to be a facilitator or a therapist supporting people through it. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's not just you just give them the MDMA and the everything, you know, you just go with it. There's a lot there. There are layers. And it's really important to talk about the ethical considerations, the things that really good therapists and facilitators go through in their own personal work to maintain a clean container, and what it's like to be in integrity with all of that. Now, I also have to confess that before I pushed record, I had a bite of chocolate and the caffeine from it definitely sped up my voice. So you're going to hear me taking some deep breaths to ground throughout the recording. Please enjoy my slightly hyper, somewhat tangential, and ever playful, always, always informative antics. Now, before we get to Jonathan, every month I've been leading my signature Undone classes online for femme and women. These classes are designed to bring you to your edge of comfort by flowing through embodiment and breathwork practices in, get this, your underwear. So we come together online to undo the negative messages that society says about what it means to be in your body or what it means to be in your sensuality, especially around other women and femme. Personally, if we're all doing this inner work, or if we're doing psychedelics, or we're doing, you know, this, I want to come into my divine embodiment around my eroticism, but if we're not doing the consistent work, if we're not doing the integration, if we're not, you know, continuously coming to that place, then is it actually going to change us? Or is it just going to be like one-off experiences? I really believe in integration. I really believe that the consistency and really the community is key for this. And so here's my offering to give you that safe place that you can. The link is in the show notes, so be sure to check it out for the monthly event. Now to Jonathan Robinson, who is a psychotherapist and author of several best-selling books, including Ecstasy as Medicine, How MDMA Therapy Can Help You to Overcome Trauma, Anxiety, and Depression and Feel More Love. He's been featured as a guest on The Oprah Show, CNN, and as an expert having led over 600 guided psychedelic journeys over the years. And I think it's even more than that by now. Right?
Yeah, I think we're hitting 800 at this point.
Oh, shit. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Looking forward to it, Dr. Kat.
Yeah. So Jonathan and I were scheduled to have a recording a couple weeks ago, and I had just gone through a breakup with a boyfriend the day before. Here's the announcement on my podcast. So I emailed him. And I was like, Jonathan, this isn't going to work right now. I can't even focus on it. I've got Taylor Swift playing on repeat. My eyes are bloodshot. And not because I was high, but because I was crying my little baby eyes out. Yeah. But, you know, after I canceled, I thought, maybe we just have an on-air MDMA session together. I probably have some good content for you.
Yeah, right. The MDMA might be easier.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. Actually, I haven't done psychedelics since the breakup. I think there is something to be said about from the sessions that I've done over the years, or the ceremony work that I've done over years, also being able to recognize that at this point, I also have a I don't need to, that it, mm-hmm. I have so much lessons that I've learned from these experiences, like this psychedelic consciousness, this floodlight of awareness that I can sit with myself and that I can be with these lessons that, you know, integrate these lessons that I've learned.
That's great.
Yeah. Even just to remind people, because I see where we can habituate ourselves to just go straight into the psychedelics rather than as, oh, I went through a breakup or I went through this thing. I need to do the psychedelic right now to, you know, to help me process mm-hmm. that. But mm-hmm. can we also find the empowerment of ourselves after these experiences that we've done before?
Yeah, well, hopefully these medicines are used in a way that help your daily life. They're not best used as crutches. You know, I use the analogy, you can use a laptop as a doorstop, but there's better uses for a laptop than as a doorstop. There's better uses for MDMA than as a crutch or as a dance party drug, which many people used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is great, dancing. But also there's this whole element to it with the therapeutic element to it, mm-hmm. Which is why I'm so excited to have you on here. You know, Jonathan, most of my colleagues are afraid to discuss matters of underground psychedelic therapies. And yet you're so open. I've seen you mm-hmm. on so many podcasts. I've read your book. You've been out there advocating for this, training people on this, like really you know, taking the curtain back and showing people what's happening back there. How are you so open? Are you not afraid of anything?
Well, you know, it's partly a philosophical thing. I do have a bunch of cops that are clients coming to me for PTSD. Mm-hmm. That helps. Also, I think people recognize that, you know, there's 120,000 people dying of fentanyl every year in the United States. Approximately 6 dying of MDMA overdose. So that's a 500-to-1 or something ratio. And I don't think cops or law enforcement are interested in trying to nab one person doing one therapeutic session to help somebody. Mm-hmm. When dozens of people are dying every single day of fentanyl and other drugs. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is that the FDA is likely to make MDMA a medically prescribed drug in August of this year. So, you know, why bother going after one person with one? And the other thing is I'm actually not doing anything illegal. I do almost all my sessions over Zoom. And when I say that to people, their head explodes because they can't believe you can do this over Zoom. I've done about 600 sessions over Zoom, in my office, and then about 200 over Zoom. And the ones over Zoom do seem to have better results. And we can discuss why that might be the case, but that surprised everyone. When I talked to Rick Doblin of MAPS, he like, oh my God, that opens up a whole new thing. That's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, talking to people over Zoom is legal. And so I'm more than happy to say that that's what I do for a living.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I do ketamine over Zoom and I mm-hmm. do a lot of sessions, you know, talk therapy sessions, somatic therapy sessions over Zoom too. And I get the same thing. People are like, oh, I don't want to be on the screen. It's not going to be the same. It's not going to have the same. And yet I've had the most profound experiences of people over Zoom. It actually hasn't changed, or, you know, whereas people think it's going to be worse, it hasn't. There's something really potent about them being at home in the safety of their own container.
Right.
That's unique to it.
And then they don't have to worry about how do they get home.
Right.
And, you know, there's also a kind of focus on Zoom. There's just you and me talking mm-hmm. directly to each other, which is different. You know, a lot of my clients have been sexually harassed or raped mm-hmm. and coming to an office and taking a drug with a relative stranger is a big ask when people have been through an experience like that. Yeah. So Zoom creates a very safe ethical boundary. I just find that it works really much better for everyone.
Mm, that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about that. Where my mind went was, wouldn't somebody want somebody in that space to hold that container if they have sexual trauma or you know, severe trauma? Like, especially I'm thinking like complex PTSD or, you know, some of these traumas from early child age where that safety piece and the relational piece is so important. But yeah. You're suggesting this is a level for ethical protection.
Yeah, they feel physically safe because I'm not in the room with them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
For people who want that sense of additional safety, I suggest that they have a friend in their house or apartment that can create a sense of a person being there. If they want to cuddle with someone or be held, they have that option, and it's not me. I don't think I should be playing that role. That can be a slippery and dangerous slope. So for many people, they do have a friend if they want that additional layer of safety with them in their own house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I love hearing about this. I don't feel that there's enough conversation about, you know, we talk about MDMA and psychedelics as being this big panacea tool. Use it, it'll heal all your child wounds in one ayahuasca sitting, you know, and yet to hear you hold this conversation of the safety, the ethics, you know, the importance of that container.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I just completed, I largely train therapists, coaches, healers now on how to do this work. I just completed a training. I had 280 people on it. I'm doing another, you know, 30-week training starting in the fall with the Shift Network. And there's a lot to know to do this right. You know, it's like brain surgery. You don't want to go in there and just say, hey, well, let's give this a shot. You know, you want to do it exactly right so you get the best outcomes. There's some people that really shouldn't be taking MDMA. There's contraindications with other medicines. There's therapeutic processes that work really, really well. And ones that, you know, I don't think are that great. Even the MAPS protocol, which is the one that's likely to get the FDA approval, they basically just put a blindfold on person and then listen to music. Whereas mine is much more like a 5-hour, very profound, in-depth psychotherapy session using lots of very powerful techniques. So the results tend to be really profound if you do it right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I studied with MAPS. That's where I got one of my trainings for the MDMA. Mm-hmm. And I find that too, it's such a potent space for utilizing therapy in that experience. Mm-hmm. That there's power in, and it's still client-led. It's not, you know, us imposing our own thoughts or interpretations, but it's there is something really potent about, you know, opening somebody's really increasing the threshold of what somebody can tolerate so that they can be with some of these experiences like trauma or distress or emotions that would otherwise dysregulate them.
Yeah, and also, you know, the medicine seems to bring up the stuff that needs to be brought up. So you follow the medicine. Many years ago, my wife and I were having trouble. She was very angry at me and for reasons that we didn't understand. And after like 3 or 4 months of this, which was quite unpleasant, I asked a friend to be an MDMA therapist for us. And what came up was that her aunt had died 3 months earlier, and she had not visited her aunt during her dying days, and she was mad at herself, and she was taking it out on me. Well, she didn't even realize this. I didn't realize it. And after a good cry with me holding her, all that anger disappeared, and you know, she worked on some self-forgiveness. So sometimes a person doesn't even know what the issue is, but the medicine seems to bring it up. And, and that's one of the great advantages of this medicine.
Yeah. What do you think it is that allows somebody to access something that they didn't even realize was a connection?
Well, I think we normally live like on the surface of our psychological wounds and brains. And this kind of just brings you down to a different level. At that different level, it in a safe environment, with the safety of the medicine, it shows up, and then you can work on it.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so as we tie that in with MDMA. You know, it's known as the love drug. It's it's known as something that can be helpful with relationships. I think that was the original intention back in the early days of MDMA. What was that? Yeah. 80s, 70s?
Well, really in the late 70s.
Yeah. And you were an early pioneer of that, as I know.
I did my master's thesis in 1984 on the therapeutic effects of MDMA on trauma. And then 2 weeks later, the U.S. government made it illegal.
Yeah. What was that like for you? Just to pause and just tune into that time period for you to be like, I just did this research.
It was like discovering diamonds in your backyard. It's like, why isn't everybody doing this? You know, because I could solve trauma that people had had for decades in one day. I'm going, my God, why isn't everybody doing this? And the same thing with couples. You know, people have taken it with their husband, wife, or mate, and it's an amazing medicine. And in the 70s, that's how it got popular, is that therapists would give it to couples who had been with them for like 5 years. And then in one day, the relationship would be repaired. Well, so I'm doing the only couples training in the world starting in fall. Because, it's been illegal and people haven't been willing to do that. But I'm doing a training through the Shift Network on MDMA couples training. And you know, a lot of couples do it, but they're not guided in a way that's most beneficial. So you add the love drug plus some proper guiding and you get miracles in a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you are supporting clients in that, when you're supporting couples, do you have a specific layout of how the next 4 or 5 hours go with the MDMA? Do you have specific stages you take people through? Do you have specific prompts? What does that look like?
Yeah, those are great questions. I do. And you always have to balance out your, you know, method, agenda, and ideas with what's being shown to you in that moment.
Yeah.
So the best laid plans, you know, sometimes go different. But I like to make sure that people are first emotionally connected really deeply. You're trying to help a couple that doesn't like each other or is annoyed and doesn't trust each other is really challenging, if not impossible. You know, so a lot of times, you know, you could go through 2 years of couples therapy. And it's a long, slow slog in which not much is happening. Mm-hmm. Well, when couples love each other and they trust each other, working through problems takes about 10 minutes. You know, so I start there, getting people to that place of connection. And then once that's happening, we bring up the difficult issues. We talk about them. We negotiate. I never have couples come into my office and say, we really understand each other perfectly. That's why we want a divorce. Mm-hmm. You know, so I help couples really understand each other emotionally, intellectually, in a way that really leads to a letting go of animosity and a lot of forgiveness. And then there's usually a negotiation stage. Okay, what do we do about the parenting? What do we do about money? What do we do about sexuality? All these things. I have them come to agreements. And then a week later, when we do an integration session, we see, are those agreements still good? And 95% of the time they are. So I have a big emphasis on making sure people take the insights and can actually apply them into their day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, how do you take the abstract ideas and concepts and put that into practical tools? I mean, integration is such a big piece of any of this work that we do.
Yeah, I think that's often missing in the psychedelic space, you know? Yeah. The idea that we'll have this experience and everything changes. No, you really have to have a system for bringing those insights into life and even a motivational system to make sure that continues over time. And that's been a big part of my protocol as well, as some unusual, as you probably read in my book, unusual motivational methods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's anytime I have a client who comes to me or with a sense of urgency and they're looking for, you know, the medicine or the ketamine to fix the urgency that they're having. It's always like a signal in me, okay, let's slow everything down and let's get to know this, the relationship to the urgency, so that mm-hmm. they don't just put all the power on the substance to heal them.
Yeah.
But there's an understanding of what's driving that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although there can be transformations quickly, most transformations happen over a period of time. The medicine gives you clarity, gives you a big breakthrough, but then you have to translate those breakthroughs into day-to-day life and different behaviors.
Yeah. Yeah. So when this, so as we're looking at MDMA with couples, you know, as we're talking mm-hmm. about couples, is there couples that you would see or that would come to you that you would say, nope, there's too many red flags that you would not be appropriate for MDMA?
Well, not on a psychological issue with each other, but it does happen in terms of health issues.
Okay.
You're really not supposed to mix ecstasy or MDMA with antidepressants, and that's right. a common thing, and mm-hmm. other medicines as well. So, I'd say 20% of the couples come to me, they either are not appropriate for it, or they have to wean themselves off certain medicines before it can be available for that.
Sure, sure. Well, I know that MDMA, like one of its hallmarks of it is that it increases that threshold of what you can tolerate or be with, or mm-hmm. you can hold so much more. But then what about those people who are in, you know, relationships where that's not beneficial to keep opening that window of tolerance because they're not able to get out? It's like they just keep falling back in love, but it's not, it's like the thing hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Or like abusive relationships or things like that.
Right, right. I do have some experience with that. And often what happens is many couples get stuck in a unfortunate and destructive limbo state.
Mm.
You know, there's some abuse, or there's something that's keeping them tied together, and then something that's pulling them apart. And they just are in immense suffering for a long period of time because they can't get out of that limbo state. And what I find is that the MDMA shoots them out somehow. And that might even look like them getting a divorce or separating, whereas before they weren't willing to. Mm. So clarity is very powerful. And also, for couples that have had any kind of physical abuse, I won't work with them unless they agree and actually pay up front for some integration sessions, mm-hmm. because that's not something I can tolerate, meaning they have to be willing to really decide that they are changing something. And my motivational methods are so good that if they do them, which take about 5 minutes a week, change is absolutely guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And now, not everybody's willing to do the motivational method that takes 5 minutes a week, but if they do, I have never seen them not change.
Yeah, and the not willingness, that's a whole nother therapy sessions.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Develop a relationship with that.
Yeah.
And then before we hopped on the call, we were jamming a bit about how MDMA can be helpful for sex therapy. And I remember in my, I'm going to say my young adult years, I don't think I'd be considered a young adult anymore, but where I would hear the myth of like, don't do MDMA because it ruins your sex life, because sex without it is never the same. You know, but that's not what I've experienced as an expert, but I'm curious how you would respond to that. Cause it's still something I get asked on in podcasts and things.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you probably know, at least for a guy, MDMA, you really can't have an orgasm on MDMA, or it's almost impossible.
Physical orgasm.
Yeah. Right.
You can
have
energetic orgasms.
Absolutely. So I don't think of it so much as a sex drug. I do think of it as a love drug. Mm-hmm. The way I use MDMA in terms of sex is a lot of couples really avoid talking about sex openly and honestly until they're on MDMA, in which case you can go into granular detail about what's working for both people. I always record the sessions or have my couples record them so that they can listen and get a sense of exactly what my partner likes, exactly what I need, exactly what is going to lead to the best sex. So then they can improve their sex life after they take, you know, once they're off the medicine. Mm-hmm. So I find it incredibly helpful because those conversations usually do not happen very well without MDMA.
Yeah. 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 It allows us to access those harder emotions or some of these things of shame, mm-hmm. especially around sex. Yeah. Yeah. I also find that it can be really helpful in moving away from the linear idea of sex mm-hmm. and being more like dropping into the pleasure as the compass or, you know, following just what feels good versus just being focused on, you know, the functioning of our genitals or driving home for an orgasm as the end goal.
Yeah. And one of the great things about psychedelics in general is it can give people an introduction to a whole new way of being.
Oh, yeah.
Your men are often so driven for orgasm that they don't realize, oh, I can really enjoy this energetic sex or this mm-hmm. tantric sex or this gazing in each other's eyes or whatever, you know, might be a different avenue for them. So once they've had that experience in a positive way, it can open up new doors for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And for those of you who might be interested, who are listening, I just did a webinar with the Psychedelic Association of Canada that you can mm-hmm. check out on YouTube called Sex Love Psychedelics. There's also a new one coming out, Sex Love Psychedelics 2.0, where we get into this and we get into consent considerations, MDMA research on this as well. So high recommend that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it's something that might be useful for your audience if they are interested in learning how to do this type of facilitation. They can either email me and they can take my 10-week program or my 30-week program coming up. They can learn about that at MDMACouplesTraining.com.
You talk a lot about MDMA. I talk about ketamine as well. Do you have experience with ketamine? And could you see different populations being more appropriate for MDMA versus ketamine? Or what have you seen?
Well, I have less experience with ketamine, but it does have an advantage in that it's not, you know, it is a medically prescribed drug, mm-hmm. so it's not illegal. And I think it has other advantages in that, you know, instead of a 5-hour trip, you can make a 2-hour trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, it has more research showing that it works better for some people with treatment-resistant depression. But I mostly use it as like a anxiety reducer in a similar way as MDMA, in that instead of it being 5 hours and big after effects, it's, you know, 1 hour and you can explore stuff. So recently I have been using it with people, and also it can be really good to help people learn what meditation is like.
Ooh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it does quiet your mind. It kind of just makes you present if you get the right dose. And I've had people who, you know, have very anxious minds and they go, oh my God, my mind is like quiet. This mm-hmm. is this what meditation's about? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like a meditation training wheels. And
oh, I love this.
And once you know a certain state, yeah. it's easier to get back there in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like so, a reference point. Yeah.
And we're blessed, you know, for the first time in history that whether it be ketamine or psilocybin or MDMA, there's a lot of medicines available and they each mm-hmm. have different uses. And some people don't react well to one medicine, but they react well to the other one. So mm-hmm. It's really kind of fun to play mad scientist and say, I think ketamine's your ticket here.
Mm-hmm.
Or even mixing medicines, like, you know, maybe a 0.5 gram of psilocybin along with the MDMA, which is called
hippie flipping.
Yeah. Or there's also kitty flipping, a little bit of ketamine with MDMA. But those are things that you should only do if you have a therapist with a lot of experience, because you can also get in trouble anytime you mix medicines.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Yeah, I love the inclusive conversation that you have with these different medications, because you're right. They each have their own texture, their own benefits, their own ways of working with us. And I hear time and time again these conversations that are very divisive of no, only organic substances, no chemical, or, you know, that's bad or that's wrong, or.
Yeah, well, I have a very big bias in this area. You should only use substances that work for you.
Bless.
Okay. No, yeah. Nobody's using that conversation. You know, hemlock is very organic and it will kill you, you know, so I don't recommend it. So what I noticed is that some people really, their body reacts really well to MDMA. I'm one of them. I could take, you know, I have no after effects from MDMA whatsoever, other than life is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Other people I've seen, they are like down in the dumps for 4 days. And I tell them, well, maybe that's not your medicine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really, really important.
You know, they think, well, psilocybin mushrooms, that's organic, and they have a terrible trip. So I say, maybe that's a lesson that you shouldn't be doing something that always makes you feel terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can we invite more inclusivity and allow people to find what works authentically for them versus trying to subscribe one prescription to everybody?
Yeah. It's nice to work with different medicines, because if all you have is a hammer, everybody looks like a nail. But if you have many different things that you have familiarity with, then you can be more used to more people, because you're not attached to a particular agenda.
Ooh, that's interesting. So, because that's different than some arguments that you need to become a master at one, or the more that you stay with one and deepen into that one, that you become proficient of it, but here you're saying learn about multiple of them.
Well, I'd say at least get proficient with a couple of medicines and a couple of different protocols.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do this interactive protocol, but I've had people say to me, you know, I'd like to be listening to music and with a blindfold on. And I say, great, I want to serve you. And halfway through, I'm going to ask you, do you want to talk about anything? And if you say no, I'm going to say, great, you know, but if you do, I'm here for you.
Yeah.
So giving people choices and knowing that it's not a one size fits all thing is I think, a way to serve our population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. So talking about couples work, you know, couples, you enjoy working with couples. What do you find to be different about working with individuals versus couples?
Well, it is harder to work with couples than individuals. You know, it's like, you know, when you're watching baseball, you can kind of drink a beer and talk to your buddy. Not that much is going on every second. You know, with basketball, you know, you blink and there were three things that just happened.
Yeah. So
it's the same with an individual. You know, it's a little bit more relaxing. You're just kind of hanging with couples, every nuance of their looks, who's talking, when they're talking, what they're saying to you. You have both individuals, you have the relationship between them. It's just more intense. That's why my couples training is a lot longer than my individual training.
Of course.
You know, when I lead other healers in this. And I kind of find that fun, because it is like, you know, I'm not a big baseball fan, but I do like basketball, because it's always some action going on. And also, I think that I've seen more maybe amazing results, where I've had couples who have literally been at each other's throats for 30 years. They can't even sit on the same couch together. And then at the end of the session, it's like, just their hearts are healed, their spirits are healed, they've worked out stuff. That's a pretty amazing thing to watch. It usually leads me to being in tears and them in tears. You know, like maybe they had an infidelity or something like that that they just couldn't get over. And then somehow something changes and they do get over whatever was their obstacle to love.
Yeah. Yeah. I have the most I also feel emotional watching those and getting to witness those moments of reparation and yeah, or when somebody owns, you know, holds their own vulnerability and then their partner witnesses them or pulls them in. I'm like inside, I'm like, oh, it's so good.
No, it's one of the most miraculous things you can watch as a human being.
Oh my God, this is great. When talking about MDMA as it's relating to sensuality or sexuality, too, I think being clear about why we're really, I guess, any use of the MDMA, why are we using this substance? Are we using this to suppress feelings that we're having? Or are we using this to override a state? Or are we using this to, like, what is this, the intention? Would we still do these things if we were in a sober state, or is this something that we're doing to be someone who is quote unquote more open or quote unquote more sex positive?
Well, you're right that intention becomes really key. And in my book, Ecstasy as Medicine, I talk about, you know, doing it with a partner and you know, you can have intention just to have a good time. Mm-hmm. Or you can have an intention to improve the communication in your relationship or improve the sexuality in your relationship. But it's good for both partners to be clear about their boundaries or about what their intention is or what they hope to get out of it. And if you do that really clearly, you're much more likely to have a good experience. I also have questions in the book like you might want to explore with your partner so that you can deal with some of the sticky obstacles that sometimes get in the way of good sex or good loving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like that in your book, that there are different questions or different points for people to tune into, to deepen their process in the thinking, but not just the thinking, the feeling as well. Can you speak to the importance of bringing awareness into the feeling just as much as the thinking process is?
Well, we're very feeling creatures. What we feel, we take as real. But in our daily lives, with all the stuff that we have to do, we often don't drop down into, how do I really feel about this? Or what is the feeling that's blocking me from peace? Or why do I get annoyed at my partner so much? And so MDMA is kind of a like a ceremonial way for us to really look at that stuff other than just from our head. You know, a lot of therapy is very heady.
Yeah.
You know, and we in the West are very much in our head, and we kind of need these helpers to get a little bit down there. I'm a guy, you know, feelings are not my forte, but on MDMA, I'm amazing, you know? So I use it as a tool to help me in that way. And I have a funny story about my parents along this line. They were wondering why I was so enthusiastic about this drug. And I said, well, you know, the only way to really know is if you take it. And they said, well, yeah, we'd be willing to take it. So I gave them some medicine and gave them some instructions about how to take it. Well, a year later, I asked them if they had ever taken it. And they said, yeah, we did take it. And I said, well, what happened? And they said, really, nothing happened. And I was kind of amazed at that. I said, well, you know, they were both very intellectual. They're gone now, but they're very intellectual people. And they said, well, nothing really happened. And so I said, well, what'd you do that evening? And their eyes lit up and they said, well, you know, once the drug didn't take effect, we waited like 20 minutes. Well, it takes usually about 40 minutes for to take effect. But once we thought it didn't take effect, we didn't have anything planned for the evening. So we sat on the couch and we ended up having the most glorious night of our entire marriage. We talked about how much we loved each other and you know, why we sometimes argue and what was in the way. And then we talked about how much we loved the kids, and it just ended up being such an amazing evening. The only problem was that the drug never took effect. And of course, I'm laughing, knowing that that's exactly what the drug was doing, but they didn't recognize it. And one of the things I like about MDMA is it doesn't make you feel like the other psychedelics where you're hallucinating or having, it makes you feel more human, more loving, more open, more available for your true feelings to come out. And I think that's a medicine that we all could use in this day and age.
Yeah, it's like, I think they call it an intactogen sometimes, like being intact with the feeling parts, your body, not shooting out of it, but being deeply present with it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a good antidote to the headiness of which we often fall into during our lives.
Yeah, yeah. I've spoken about this before, but not really in depth. But the first time that I had had experience with MDMA therapy was in my early 20s, actually. I was working with somebody as an underground therapist and experiencing for the first time being able to say out loud what had happened to me when I was younger. And it was an interesting experience. I was quiet for most of the session. And then about halfway through, things just started coming out. And what was really profound about that was it almost broke that seal that was preventing words from coming forward again. And then from there, it had changed the relationship that I had around this one thing. So when you're working with clients, do you have clients who sometimes don't say anything at all and still experience change? Or do you find that it's that they need to have the verbal aspect of it?
Well, I do a very verbal interactive approach protocol. You know, the MAPS training or the MAPS protocol is very much less or not at all verbal. And they do show that people do get better through that protocol. I think that it can be improved upon through at least some interaction and some direction. So that's what I do. But the FDA, in order to get the approval that they were seeking, you know, the FDA is called the Food and Drug Administration. It's not called the Food and Therapy Administration. So they wanted to see if just giving somebody a pill and putting a blindfold on them would heal them. And the results show that, yeah, it's very effective, even in that nonverbal situation.
Yeah. Okay. So given that information, what do you think would be, because a lot of people are jumping out there, be new facilitators, and we are seeing that there are some implications with that. You know, there are people that are getting re-traumatized because of that. What would you say to people who are aspiring facilitators or who are new in that experience?
Well, this isn't self-serving at all, but I tell them to take my training.
Got it, Jonathan.
Yeah, right. Or at least buy the book and learn how to avoid problems, you know, because it is a art and skill, and you can get, you know, it's a powerful medicine. Anything that's powerful, whether it be money or sex or drugs, can be easily abused. And is. So the more information, the more training you have, the better. And also, I do think that the doing it over Zoom does avoid some of the ethical and other problems that people are facing as well. So we want to make sure that these medicines have the biggest and most positive and safest impact. And to do that, you do need to. And, you know, in the early days, I was kind of reckless, you know. Once I was gaining these amazing results, I said, this should be in the water supply, you know. But I learned through, you know, trial and error and some mistakes, like, oh, no, things can go poorly if you don't do this well and you don't take some precautions.
Do you have any of those cautionary tales that you could share?
Well, yeah, I can. I mean, before I started doing this as an underground therapist for a lot, the biggest thing I noticed was that some people weren't having any effect. And that was usually because they were on antidepressants and the two things neutralized each other. So, you know, that was a big waste of time and energy for everyone. But, you know, I think some people due to health conditions would be really out of it for 3 or 4 days afterwards.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel good about that. So I can now ascertain whether it's appropriate with their current situations. In the book and in my trainings, I talk about like 8 or 10 supplements that you can do that tend to prevent those types of side effects. I talk a lot about getting pure medicine and testing medicine because almost half the medicine in America, MDMA, that's sold as MDMA, is impure, and that creates problems. So there are a lot of little things to know for sure. I've had people take medicine that ended up being 100% methamphetamine.
Oh.
And that led to them being up for a day and a half. And that didn't feel good for either them or me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I recently had a friend who was going to Coachella and I gave them some testing strips because they weren't even going to test. And I was like, please test.
Yeah.
And it came back that it had fentanyl in it. And it just brings up this. And I've also had dear friends in the community die from overdose of fentanyl unintentionally, obviously, but or maybe not so obviously, but the importance of taking that time to take care of ourselves and not just assume that it's safe.
Right, right. I talk a lot about getting safe medicine in my training and how to test for MDMA and fentanyl strips. And, you know, there's a lot there to make sure you're doing it safely.
How do you speak to people about the concept of countertransference?
That's one of the advantages of doing it on Zoom is that, you know, countertransference is a major issue when somebody's, you know, might be, you know, you're an attractive woman. People coming to you can easily project all their stuff onto you in some ways. And that is a major issue when people, when there's not a very clear boundary on Zoom, I find that that becomes literally not an issue. One time, maybe out of 200, it even showed up at all. So whereas it shows up a lot, you know, if you're doing it with somebody in your office. So I you know, might tell somebody who's being a little bit overly enthusiastic about how wonderful I am. I say, well, you know, I appreciate your compliments and that love that you're feeling is really inside you. And and that's what we're here to explore, how you can get back to that place. In fact, a lot of my clients come to me for spiritual expansion as much as trauma work, because it does open up that place of love. And I want to help people get to that place without the medicine as well.
Again, the integration piece, speaking to that. So you're talking about transference, and it sounds like primarily romantic transference, but what about counter transference where the therapist or the facilitator is projecting onto the client or using the client for their own needs unknowingly?
Well, in my trainings, I talk about that a lot because I want to make sure that you're coming from as pure a place as possible. You know, the old Socrates term, know thyself and know your tendencies and know what is likely to happen. In the trainings, there's a lot of feedback from people that you work with. So you get to see, am I doing that? Is that something that's a problem for me? I think getting feedback and knowing yourself, which is a major part of the trainings, is an important ingredient so you're not hurting people in any way.
Right. Yeah. One solution that I always talk about is, you know, not to work in a silo, like have consultation groups or working with other people to be able to talk about that, but also do your own coaching or therapy work that reflects to you so you can see what may be in the shadows, or you might be reacting to a client and not realize that that's not their stuff. That's ours.
Right. And in my trains, we do have like small groups so that people can give feedback. And we have a Telegram group. So all 280 people were talking. We had a transference and counter transference thread so that people could talk about those things.
Bless. Oh, I love that. Do you, in your experience over the years, did you have a point where you felt that you were, I don't know, responded from something from your shadow or something that you transferred onto a client?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the question is, when you make a mistake like that, can you notice it in its smallest micro detail, or do you need to really like go all overboard before you even notice it? And so I try to be aware of what my tendencies are that way, and only go an inch over what I think is right rather than a mile over. Mm-hmm. But yeah, especially in the early days, I would notice things and I would get feedback and I would have to self-correct. And I'm not beyond the, doing those minor transgressions. And when I say minor transgressions, I might be like, I'm a little bit annoyed, so I'm saying something out of annoyance. It's not like I'm violating boundaries or things, but you want to be aware of those small things so that, and small biases, you know, if somebody's like, you know, very focused on making more money, I might do my thing. Well, hey, really, it's love that's important, you know, or it's relationship that's important. Well, I want to make sure I'm not trying to put my worldview and you know, pound it into them. Instead, I'm trying to heal what is important to them.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I love that. Not trying to override their values with your own values.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And it's, and I love that you pointed out like the nuances of these things, because you know, I remember times even where I could feel a rising tension in my body in response to, you know, one of the people in the couple, or I would feel where I said something that was interpreted as something else from the client, and then feel the internal desire to defend myself. You know, oh, that was an misinterpretation. And like having my own therapist to be able to, you know, work those things through and see what came alive inside of me has really helped me so much in being able to maintain that cleanness, as we're describing the word clean. What does it mean to be clean in the space? And then even to see my own therapist model for me how to have a repair attempt in session made a huge difference of, you know, okay, I can make a mistake or something can be misinterpreted. And I can, how do I facilitate a repair attempt and heal that both inside of them and me. So high recommend for having another facilitator for us who are doing this facilitation work.
It's really important because we're blind to our own shortcomings, but generally other people see them.
Unless we really good at hiding our protector parts, really good at hiding those. All right. So as we're beginning to wrap this up, you know, we had talked earlier about integration and the importance of that. This whole podcast feels like a session in and of itself. There's lots of little golden nuggets in here. And as we're integrating, we're talking about integrating. Do you have any effective tools, rituals, processes that you have found helpful in that process, or models of how to do integration?
Well, I talk about that a lot in the Ecstasy as Medicine book, but a short version is I think that people should have a little bit of ongoing coaching.
Yeah.
And accountability. Accountability is really important. You know, information is not transformation. Mm-hmm. So you got to take those insights and put them into your life in very precise ways. So often people realize that there's certain techniques that they need to do or certain things in a relationship. And by being accountable to me or someone else in their life for those changes, that makes it much more likely it's going to happen. And so I put a very big emphasis on that. Of course, there's things like journaling and other stuff, but I don't think that works nearly as well as some accountability system that is in place.
Yeah, amazing. This is great, Jonathan. Love your work. Loved your book. It was really fun. Yeah.
A lot of fun for me too, Dr. Kat.
Yeah, you have a playful energy in it. I could feel it.
And, you know, I think a sense of humor can be really helpful in healing. And you add some humor, you add some MDMA, you add some good intentions and stir a little bit and magic happens.
I'm putting that on a bumper sticker. It's so great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to include all the links to your programs and your book in the show notes.
Thank you, Dr. Kat.
Well, that was fun. Thanks for tuning in, lovers. And if you want to experience more ecstasy and sexual liberation, head over to sexlovepsychedelics.com and learn about how you can join me for any one of my online or live events. And while you're there, grab my free guide on sex and psychedelics. Remember, this podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Please contact your healthcare provider and local law before pursuing any of the products or psychedelics discussed. And one final note here. I make this show specifically for you. If you're loving the show, then be sure to leave me a review in iTunes or Spotify to let me know. Happy to be here and happy to serve. I'll see you next time on Sex, Love, Psychedelics.